But that was not true. I began to realize, the afterworld I had glimpsed was both infinitely brighter than this one, and infinitely more savage and terrible. Why hadn't the evil side of that world crushed my spirit, as the negatives of this world had done? I had started reading the Bible, back in my tent, and one day I came to a psalm that seemed to help. If I ascend up into heaven, I read in Psalm 139:8, Thou art the, if I make my bed in Sheol, behold, Thou art the. Of course, that was the answer. Jesus had been there, in those scenes of Sheol. It was His light, His compassion in which I was seeing the awfulness, and that shed a ray of hope, even in hell. When the war in Europe ended in May 1945, the 123rd of Ark entered Germany with the occupying troops. I was part of a group assigned to a concentration camp near Wuppertal, charged with getting medical help to the newly liberated prisoners, many of them Jews from Holland, France, and Eastern Europe. This was the most shattering experience I had yet had. I had been exposed many times by then to sudden death and injury, but to see the effects of slow starvation, to walk through those barracks where thousands of men had died a little bit at a time over a period of years, was a new kind of horror. For many it was an irreversible process. We lost scores each day in spite of all the medicine and food we could rush to them. Now I needed my new insight indeed. When the ugliness became too great to handle, I did what I had learned to do. I went from one end to the other of that barbed wire enclosure, looking into men's faces until I saw looking back at me the face of Christ. And that is how I came to know Wild Bill Cody. That was not his real name. His real name was seven unpronounceable syllables in Polish, but he had a long drooping handlebar mustache like pictures of the old Western hero, so the American soldiers called him Wild Bill. He was one of the inmates of the concentration camp, but obviously he had not been there long. His posture was erect, his eyes bright, his energy indefatigable. Since he was fluent in English, French, German and Russian, as well as Polish, he became a kind of unofficial camp translator. We came to him with all sorts of problems. The paperwork alone was staggering in attempting to relocate people whose families, even whole hometowns, might have disappeared. But though Wild Bill worked 15 and 16 hours a day, he showed no signs of weariness. While the rest of us were drooping with fatigue, he seemed to gain strength. We have time for this old fellow, he would say. He's been waiting to see us all day. His compassion for his fellow prisoners glowed on his face, and it was to this glow that I came when my own spirits were low. So I was astonished to learn, when Wild Bill's own papers came before us one day, that he had been in Wuppertal since 1939. For 6 years he had lived on the same starvation diet, slept in the same airless and disease-ridden barracks as everyone else, but without the least physical or mental deterioration. Perhaps even more amazing, every group in the camp looked on him as a friend. He was the one to whom quarrels between inmates were brought for arbitration. Only after I had been at Wuppertal a number of weeks did I realize what a rarity this was in a compound where the different nationalities of prisoners hated each other almost as much as they did the Germans. As for Germans, feeling against them ran so high that in some of the camps liberated earlier, former prisoners had seized guns, run into the nearest village and simply shot the first Germans they saw. Part of our instructions were to prevent this kind of thing. And again Wild Bill was our greatest asset, reasoning with the different groups, counseling forgiveness. It's not easy for some of them to forgive, I commented to him one day as we sat over mugs of tea in the processing center. So many of them have lost members of their families. Wild Bill leaned back in the upright chair and sipped at his drink. We lived in the Jewish section of Warsaw, he began slowly, the first words I had heard him speak about himself. My wife, our two daughters, and our three little boys. When the Germans reached our street they lined everyone against a wall and opened up with machine guns. I begged to be allowed to die with my family, but because I spoke German they put me in a work group. He paused, perhaps seeing again his wife and five children. I had to decide right then, he continued, whether to let myself hate the soldiers who had done this. It was an easy decision, really. I was a lawyer. In my practice I had seen too often what hate could do to people's minds and bodies. Hate had just killed the 6 people who mattered most to me in the world. I decided then that I would spend the rest of my life, whether it was a few days or many years, loving every person I came in contact with. Loving every person, this was the power that had kept a man well in the face of every privation. It was the power I had first met in a hospital room in Texas, and was learning little by little to recognize wherever he chose to shine through, whether the human vehicle was aware of him or not. I returned to the States from occupation duty in Germany in the spring of 1946, and Marguerite and I were married the following year. When the moment came to tell her about the Texas experience, it happened, as it had the 2 previous times, naturally, almost effortlessly on my part, helping the love between us grow. Meanwhile, Jack Helm's hunch had proved correct. The administrator who had sworn to keep me out of there was no longer connected with the Medical College of Virginia. The man who went to bat to get me readmitted was Dr. Sidney Negus, the professor who had given me the D in biochemistry. This time I was determined not to make the mistake I had made before. My trouble began, I saw now, when I took my eyes off Jesus and on to myself. This time I did not worry about my stupidity or my poor record, and I got through school without difficulty. From the outset of my career, however, I discovered what all doctors know: medicine does not have all the answers. When stumped, as I often was, I would pray for my patient, silently, under my breath, asking Jesus' help in making the right diagnosis, prescribing the right treatment. In addition, Marguerite and I formed the habit of praying together for patients every evening. I continued to read the Bible. It was funny, in Sunday school the Bible had seemed to me both boring and difficult. Since Texas it had become simply a factual description of life. When Jesus said to some fishermen on a lakeside, "Follow me," of course they dropped everything and hurried after him, who could resist? When he said, "I am the light of the world," it was simply an observable fact. But if my experience made the Bible comprehensible, much more so, as I now began to read it systematically after the war, it was the Bible that helped me understand the experience. Reading over and over the accounts of the crucifixion, I understood at last where that certainty had come from, in his presence, that I was not condemned, in spite of the ugly actions I had committed that were paraded in plain view before us. It was his death, I came to see, that had already paid for these things, the light of his resurrection in which we stood. Why these cosmic acts should have applied to me, whether I could somehow have appropriated them in that church service at age 11. I did not know. But I began to understand, reading the Bible, how all important our lives on this earth are, in his plan. How terribly wrong I had been, on the SS Brazil, at Street Valerie, in Rethel, to detest mine, to ask him to take me out of this world before his work in me here was done. I thought of the wretched souls I had seen in that first post-earthly realm, trapped in hatreds and lusts, fixed on material things forever out of reach. Somehow none of them had finished growing up in their time on earth, whether it had been long or short. I had no trouble believing that some of the teenagers I had seen blown to bits in Europe had accomplished already the goals God had for them on earth, were well prepared to graduate to some sphere nearer him. But I certainly had not been. With my self-centeredness, my prejudices, my self-righteousness, how had I dared ask to die? In yearning for Jesus had I forgotten what he showed me? That plane, crawling with the unhappiest beings I had ever seen, each insisting on his own superiority to the annihilation of everybody else. Had I seriously wanted an eternity in some existence like that? Would I ever, in fact, reach the point where I would be willing to say, on my own, I have done what I am supposed to do on earth? Wild Bill leaned back in the upright chair and sipped at his drink. We lived in the Jewish section of Warsaw, he began slowly. The first words I had heard him speak about himself, my wife, our 2 daughters, and our three little boys. When the Germans reached our street, they lined everyone against a wall and opened up with machine guns. I begged to be allowed to die with my family, but because I spoke German, they put me in a work group. He paused, perhaps seeing again his wife and five children. I had to decide right then, he continued, whether to let myself hate the soldiers who had done this. It was an easy decision, really. I was a lawyer. In my practice, I had seen too often what hate could do to people's minds and bodies. Hate had just killed the six people who mattered most to me in the world. I decided then that I would spend the rest of my life, whether it was a few days or many years, loving every person I came in contact with. Loving every person, this was the power that had kept a man well in the face of every privation. It was the power I had first met in a hospital room in Texas, and was learning little by little to recognize wherever he chose to shine through, whether the human vehicle was aware of him or not. I returned to the States from occupation duty in Germany in the spring of 1946, and Marguerite and I were married the following year. When the moment came to tell her about the Texas experience, it happened, as it had the two previous times, naturally, almost effortlessly on my part, helping the love between us grow. Meanwhile, Jack Helm's hunch had proved correct. The administrator who had sworn to keep me out of there was no longer connected with the Medical College of Virginia. The man who went to bat to get me readmitted was Dr. Sidney Negus, the professor who had given me the D in biochemistry. This time I was determined not to make the mistake I had made before. My trouble began, I saw now, when I took my eyes off Jesus and on to myself. This time I did not worry about my stupidity or my poor record, and I got through school without difficulty. From the outset of my career, however, I discovered what all doctors know: medicine does not have all the answers. When stumped, as I often was, I would pray for my patient, silently, under my breath, asking Jesus' help in making the right diagnosis, prescribing the right treatment. In addition, Marguerite and I formed the habit of praying together for patients every evening. I continued to read the Bible. It was funny, in Sunday school the Bible had seemed to me both boring and difficult. Since Texas, it had become simply a factual description of life. When Jesus said to some fishermen on a lakeside, "Follow me," of course they dropped everything and hurried after him. Who could resist? When he said, "I am the light of the world," it was simply an observable fact. But if my experience made the Bible comprehensible, much more so, as I now began to read it systematically after the war, it was the Bible that helped me understand the experience. Reading over and over the accounts of the crucifixion, I understood at last where that certainty had come from, in his presence, that I was not condemned, in spite of the ugly actions I had committed that were paraded in plain view before us. It was his death, I came to see, that had already paid for these things, the light of his resurrection in which we stood. Why these cosmic acts should have applied to me, whether I could somehow have appropriated them in that church service at age 11. I did not know. But I began to understand, reading the Bible, how all important our lives on this earth are, in his plan. How terribly wrong I had been, on the SS Brazil, at Street Valerie, in Rethel, to detest mine, to ask him to take me out of this world before his work in me here was done. I thought of the wretched souls I had seen in that first post-earthly realm, trapped in hatreds and lusts, fixed on material things forever out of reach. Somehow none of them had finished growing up in their time on earth, whether it had been long or short. I had no trouble believing that some of the teenagers I had seen blown to bits in Europe had accomplished already the goals God had for them on earth, were well prepared to graduate to some sphere nearer him. But I certainly had not been. With my self-centeredness, my prejudices, my self-righteousness, how had I dared ask to die? In yearning for Jesus, had I forgotten what he showed me? That plane, crawling with the unhappiest beings I had ever seen, each insisting on his own superiority to the annihilation of everybody else, had I seriously wanted an eternity in some existence like that? Would I ever, in fact, reach the point where I would be willing to say, on my own, I have done what I am supposed to do on Earth? 14. One winter evening in 1952, it was around the middle of December because we had just had our annual Christmas party at the Richmond Academy of Medicine that I had recently joined, I sat in the living room reading a copy of Life magazine. The issue was full of ads for brand name turkeys and hams, with Jolly Santas on every other page, and I was flipping through it without much interest when suddenly my fingers tightened. On the page in front of me was a drawing of a gigantic sphere-shaped structure cut away to reveal men and machines inside it. There was a kind of traveling crane mounted on steel girders, turbines, a huge circular tank, stairs, catwalks, down in one corner a small control room. What set my heart pounding in my throat was not the strange futuristic appearance of these objects but the certainty that I had seen all this before. Not recently, either. Somehow, years ago, I had stood staring not at a drawing of this enormous sphere but at the thing itself. I had wondered about that peculiar interior, too. I had seen the stairway just there, peered into that vast tank of water. But I couldn't have. Skimming the text, I saw that what I remembered was impossible. Last week the Atomic Energy Commission partially lifted its veil of secrecy and allowed Life's artists to make a drawing of some details of the prototype of the second U.S. atomic submarine engine and the strange house that holds it. The building, now going up near Schenectady, NY, will be the world's largest man-made sphere, a $2 million, 225-foot steel shell. The article went on to say that to avoid possible radioactive contamination, scientists would build the submarine engine inside the sphere, then submerge it for tests in the giant tank. Baffled, I lowered the magazine to my lap. I had felt so certain I had seen this whole operation, yet I had never been to Schenectady. Anyhow, what I recalled was some time ago and this was just now being built. The thing I had seen was finished and operating, though I had not had any idea what. Then I remembered. It was in that tranquil campus-like realm inhabited by beings wrapped in thought as monks are wrapped in robes, that I had stood in 1943 as the Earth measures time, staring at a huge sphere-shaped building, walking through its intricate fittings. What was that realm? In what mysterious way was it related to the life and thought of the world where I sat in 1952, with Marguerite talking on the telephone in the hall and Christmas cards lining the mantelpiece? I did not think about it very long, except to wonder if philosophers are right when they say that certain ideas seem to drop into widely scattered areas of the world from somewhere simultaneously. I had grown wary of inquiring into superterrestrial areas on my own. As long as Christ had been my guide, there had been nothing to fear. But since my out-of-the-body experience, 9 years before, I had come across individuals who had become so fascinated by the spirit world that they seemed to have lost sight of the spirit himself. All I was sure of as I sat in the living room that evening was that the time had come to start talking far more publicly than I had until then about my encounter with Christ. If we were truly entering the age of atomic power, without knowing the power that created it, then it was only a matter of decades until we destroyed ourselves and our Earth as well. It was not enough for professional clergy to speak out. Everyone who had any experience at all of God, it seemed to me, had a responsibility. And it must again have been his timing. I, who could never string two words together, found myself talking to youth groups, clubs, churches, anyone who would listen to the message that God is love, and all else is hell. Professionally, of course, I was sure this meant the ruin of me, and doubtless I did lose some patients who were not willing to entrust themselves to a religious fanatic. But it was odd, the people whose scorn I feared most were often the most accepting. When I applied for my residency in psychiatry at the University of Virginia Hospital, I was advised by a friend on the staff not to mention my experience, since he did not know how the others might take this. The very first person to interview me turned out to be Dr. Wilfred Abbs, professor of psychoanalysis and analytical psychotherapy in the Department of Psychiatry, and one of the top men in the Virginia Psychoanalytic Society. I had no sooner stepped into his office than Dr. Abs confronted me with, "Well, Dr. Ritchie, I understand that you feel that you have met the Christ. I saw my chances at the University of Virginia floating out the window." Dr. Abs was a Jew, a Freudian analyst, and he was asking me a direct 14, one winter evening in 1952. It was around the middle of December because we had just had our annual Christmas party at the Richmond Academy of Medicine that I had recently joined. I sat in the living room reading a copy of Life magazine. The issue was full of ads for brand name turkeys and hams, with Jolly Santas on every other page, and I was flipping through it without much interest when suddenly my fingers tightened. On the page in front of me was a drawing of a gigantic sphere-shaped structure cut away to reveal men and machines inside it. There was a kind of traveling crane mounted on steel girders, turbines, a huge circular tank, stairs, catwalks, down in one corner a small control room. What set my heart pounding in my throat was not the strange futuristic appearance of these objects but the certainty that I had seen all this before. Not recently, either. Somehow, years ago, I had stood staring not at a drawing of this enormous sphere but at the thing itself. I had wondered about that peculiar interior, too. I had seen the stairway just there, peered into that vast tank of water. But I couldn't have. Skimming the text, I saw that what I remembered was impossible. Last week the Atomic Energy Commission partially lifted its veil of secrecy and allowed Life's artists to make a drawing of some details of the prototype of the second U.S. atomic submarine engine and the strange house that holds it. The building, now going up near Schenectady, NY, will be the world's largest man-made sphere, a $2 million, 225-foot steel shell. The article went on to say that to avoid possible radioactive contamination, scientists would build the submarine engine inside the sphere, then submerge it for tests in the giant tank. Baffled, I lowered the magazine to my lap. I had felt so certain I had seen this whole operation, yet I had never been to Schenectady. Anyhow, what I recalled was some time ago and this was just now being built. The thing I had seen was finished and operating, though I had not had any idea what. Then I remembered. It was in that tranquil campus-like realm inhabited by beings wrapped in thought as monks are wrapped in robes, that I had stood in 1943 as the Earth measures time, staring at a huge sphere-shaped building, walking through its intricate fittings. What was that realm? In what mysterious way was it related to the life and thought of the world where I sat in 1952, with Marguerite talking on the telephone in the hall and Christmas cards lining the mantelpiece? I did not think about it very long, except to wonder if philosophers are right when they say that certain ideas seem to drop into widely scattered areas of the world from somewhere simultaneously. I had grown wary of inquiring into superterrestrial areas on my own. As long as Christ had been my guide, there had been nothing to fear. But since my out-of-the-body experience, 9 years before, I had come across individuals who had become so fascinated by the spirit world that they seemed to have lost sight of the spirit himself. All I was sure of as I sat in the living room that evening was that the time had come to start talking far more publicly than I had until then about my encounter with Christ. If we were truly entering the age of atomic power, without knowing the power that created it, then it was only a matter of decades until we destroyed ourselves and our Earth as well. It was not enough for professional clergy to speak out. Everyone who had any experience at all of God, it seemed to me, had a responsibility. And it must again have been his timing. I, who could never string two words together, found myself talking to youth groups, clubs, churches, anyone who would listen to the message that God is love, and all else is hell. Professionally, of course, I was sure this meant the ruin of me, and doubtless I did lose some patients who were not willing to entrust themselves to a religious fanatic. But it was odd, the people whose scorn I feared most were often the most accepting. When I applied for my residency in psychiatry at the University of Virginia Hospital, I was advised by a friend on the staff not to mention my experience, since he did not know how the others might take this. The very first person to interview me turned out to be Dr. Wilfred Abbs, professor of psychoanalysis and analytical psychotherapy in the Department of Psychiatry, and one of the top men in the Virginia Psychoanalytic Society. I had no sooner stepped into his office than Dr. Abbs confronted me with, "Well, Dr. Ritchie, I understand that you feel that you have met the Christ." I saw my chances at the University of Virginia floating out the window. Dr. Abbs was a Jew, a Freudian analyst, and he was asking me a direct question that demanded an answer. Under my breath, as I had done so often, I turned to Jesus, "Lord, what do I say now? Deny me before man." The words seemed almost audible, "And I will deny you before my Father." To Dr. Abbs I said, "I can no more deny the reality of what happened to me in Barkley, Texas, than Saul of Tarsus could deny what happened to him on the road to Damascus." And that was that, I thought, for my chances of becoming a psychiatrist. Imagine my surprise, a couple of weeks later, to receive a letter telling me that I had been accepted unanimously by the examining staff. Years later, when Dr. Abbs and I had become good friends, he told me that that particular conversation had been critical indeed. "All of us up here knew that you claimed to have had an out-of-the-body experience. If you'd pretended with me even for a moment that it had not happened, I would have put you down as a deeply insecure person, and most probably an emotionally disturbed one who couldn't distinguish between fact and fancy." In the consulting room itself, of course, in keeping with sound psychiatric practice, I seldom mention my personal views of God. Only where the need is extreme, as with Fred Owen, do I violate that professional silence. "Do you know why I come to the office early each morning?" I asked him one day when we were discussing the effects in my life of the Texas experience. "Before the other doctors and staff get here? It's because I use the time to pray for each of the patients I will see that day. I believe Jesus has an agenda and a timetable for each of us, and I pray that with his help the patient and I may discover it together." If Jesus was giving Fred Owen only weeks on earth instead of decades, it's because he knows you can finish your work here in weeks. You can forgive and receive forgiveness. You can free yourself of addictions and angers, any baggage you don't want to carry into a realm where everything is light. I do not know, of course, what went on in the innermost recesses of Fred Owen's heart. Psychiatry at best is limited by what the patient shares with us. I do know that the man who came into my office on May 9, 1977, for what turned out to be our final session, was a very different person from the man I had first seen in December. Physically he was weaker, of course. In fact, a neighbor had to drive him, and Fred lay on the yellow sofa throughout the session. But the things he said between the labored breaths, and the peace, even the humor, in his eyes, filled me with joy. He had been battling with his former employers to get his hospital bills included under their health plan. I had filled out a number of forms in the case myself. That week he had received final notification that his claim had been denied, on the grounds that he had quit work without the required notice. "You know what?" he told me. "They're right. I quit because I was mad and I wanted to make problems for them. Only now I'm the one with the problems." He gave a laugh that was interrupted by a cough, but the sound was beautiful to me because it was a real laugh, a heart laugh, without a trace of bitterness in it. "It's like what we were reading, right, Doc? As you sow, so you reap. If I've learned that in time, then losing the insurance was cheap. You know what I do now that I'm not sleeping so well at night?" he went on. "I pray for those guys at work, that the shop will have a real good year. More business and profits than they know what to do with. No man, of course, may speculate on another man's experience beyond the grave, but when that same neighbor telephoned to tell me about Fred Owen's death on May 24th, I had no trouble picturing, at least, that moment of astonished transition. The growing light. The joy in the heart of a man who had done his homework well. God is busy building a race of men who know how to love. I believe that the fate of the earth itself depends on the progress we make, and that the time now is very short. As for what we will find in the next world, here, too, I believe that what we will discover that depends on how well we get on with the business of loving, here and now. The end.